My name is Duart Snow. I followed pro cycling for about 2 decades, but you have added a whole new depth and dimension to my understanding and enjoyment of the sport.
Hi, I'm Liz Miller. I download the podcast and take the guys to bed with me. Have to say, the husband is not amused when the bed often rocks with my laughter.
This is Spencer from Boulder. I let the exotic tales of faraway European races and the intrigue of insider gossip make me feel as though I'm there.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Where are we, Lionel? Not really true, that, Rich, is it? You're not with me. We're in remote locations once again.
Hence my question, where are we, Lionel?
Well, I'm at my home in my office. I assume that's where... Well, you're at your home, are you, Richard? And Daniel, where are you? That's the most pertinent thing.
I'm in a little place called Châteauneuf-sur-Isère. I'm at the Dauphiné, the Critérium du Dauphiné, the Dauphiné Libéré, as we should all still call it. And yeah, that's a little village on the Rhône or in the Rhône Valley. Today's stage finished in a place called Tournos or Rhône, just down the road from there. Beautiful view, can hear the cicadas singing. Do they sing cicadas? Probably not. What do they do, cicadas? Don't know. Anyway, in the shadow of some beautiful vineyards. So yeah, I'm in a much better place than you guys.
So I should have introduced you, sorry, as television's Daniel Freeb, doing a bit of moonlighting this week for ITV, Daniel. But we'll get on to the Dauphiné soon. But before we do that, Lionel, can you give us our weekly roundup, please?
It's been a busy few weeks, and of course we've been concentrating on the Giro d'Italia, so we need to get up to speed with some of the bigger events in the world of cycling. Before the Giro, it was announced that Simon Yates, the British rider with Orica GreenEdge, had failed a doping test at Paris-Nice in March. The substance involved was terbutaline, an asthma medicine, and his team said that an administrative error meant that the team doctor had not applied for a therapeutic use exemption, which would have permitted Yates to use the drug. Orica GreenEdge had initially hoped that Yates would be able to ride the Dauphiné this week, and he was originally in the team lineup, but the situation has not yet been resolved one way or the other, so we'll watch and see what happens there. Meanwhile, Team Sky's Colombian climber Sergio Henao is back in action at the Dauphiné. Henao had been withdrawn from racing by his team while his biological passport data was analysed by experts. The UCI and Cycling's Anti-Doping Foundation have found no evidence of anti-doping violation, and so Henao is free to race on. Also, while the Giro was underway at the Tour of Belgium, there was another serious motorcycle incident, this time involving 2 motorbikes. One reportedly collided with another, and both were sent into the path of the peloton. Several riders were badly hurt, with Lotto Soudal's Stig Brooks the most seriously hurt. Brooks was in a coma and was in a critical condition for a couple of weeks, but his team announced on Wednesday that his situation is no longer life-threatening, so that is good news. It's been a terrible year for Brooks. You may remember he was hit by a motorbike during Brussels-Kerner back in February as well. We covered the issue of motorcycle safety after the death of Antoine de Moitier at Gent-Wevelgem earlier this year, but one race that has taken a proactive step to improve things is the Heist Appeal, a 1.1-ranked one-day race in Belgium, which was a few days ago now. They experimented with a system of red and green signs on the roadside to show motorcycles working in the race where it's safe to pass and where it's not safe to pass the riders. And we'll see if that experiment gains any traction. A new, presumably big-budget team backed by Prince Nasser bin Hamed Al Khalifa, who is the son of the King of Bahrain, intends to enter the World Tour in 2017, with the Giro champion Vincenzo Nibali top of the shopping list. However, a quick look at Amnesty International's report on Bahrain, the country starts on human rights and torture and questions over whether the prince is a fit and proper person to run a sports team, may yet throw the project into jeopardy. It will be interesting to follow the UCI's response to this one in the coming weeks. In lighter news, the World Road Race champion Peter Sagan is set to ride the cross-country mountain bike event at the Rio Olympics for Slovakia. And Mark Cavendish strengthened his bid to take Great Britain's place in the Omnium on the track by winning Omnium race in Lithuania at the weekend. One man who won't be in Rio is the American TJ Van Garderen, who's pulled out because of concerns over the Zika virus. In transfer news, Geraint Thomas has extended his deal with Sky by a year to the end of 2017, and Philippe Gilbert is to leave BMC Racing at the end of the season. Finally, a roundup of the races that have been going on over the past few weeks. Julian Alaphilippe of Etics Quickstep won the Amgen Tour of California. The Tour of Belgium was won by Dries De Venins of I Am Cycling. Moritz Lamertink of Roompot won the Tour of Luxembourg, where Gilbert won a couple of stages. The Women's Tour of California was won by Megan Guarnier, who also won the Philadelphia International Classic, taking Bol Stolman's World Tour wins to 7 from 9 events. Next up is the Women's Tour, and we'll have more on that in our first edition of the cycling podcast Feminam, which launches next week. In men's road racing, the Dauphiné is in full swing, and we'll be discussing that in the rest of this episode.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport, who are still sponsoring Cycling Podcast. On Eurosport at the moment, live is the Critérium du Dauphiné, or the Dauphiné Libéré. Tour de Suisse begins on Saturday, and stages 1 and 8 are live, 2 to 7, and the prologue will be shown on a delay. It's available on the Eurosport player, as is the Route du Sud, which begins next week and will also be shown on a delay. Thank you to Eurosport. Again, I should also mention the documentary that they have shown once already as we speak, and it's going to be shown another couple of times. That is Nairo Quintana, Little Big Man, and that is shown on Friday the 10th of June at 8 o'clock and Saturday the 11th of June at 11 p.m. So have a look at that. Very interesting little documentary about Nairo Quintana, who isn't very active, it seems, at the moment. He's not riding at the Dauphiné or the Tour de Suisse. But Lionel, we heard your roundup there just before the break, and you had something to say, I think, about that, the name of the race, the Dauphiné. Some more questions about that?
Well, just a point of order, really. I do agree with Daniel that, you know, we should... A nod to the history of the race, the Critérium du Dauphiné Libéré used to be called because it was founded by the newspaper, the Dauphiné Libéré, which was rebranded the Dauphiné and, of course, no longer has any direct involvement with the race since ASO took it over a number of years ago now, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago perhaps now. But, yeah, yet another race started by a newspaper. But, yeah, still can't, even after all these years, still can't stop thinking of it as the Dauphiné Libéré. That's just how it is in my brain, unfortunately.
Indeed. Well, you are a traditionalist, Lionel. We'll talk about the Dauphiné in a minute. This is our first post-Giro podcast. It was a pretty exhausting Giro, pretty intense, wasn't it, for all three of us? Have you both recovered?
Yeah, I have, Rich. Straight back onto another race for me, so not too much downtime in between. But, yeah, feeling quite sprightly now as we head into Tour de France time. You know,
you're a bit like Valerio Conti, who's one rider who's gone straight from the Giro to the Dauphiné. I realise, are there many others?
There are a few others. Chad Hager is one. I spoke to Hager, yeah, in Turin on the last day of the Giro, and I wouldn't say he was terribly looking forward to having to go straight to the Dauphiné, but there are a few others in that same boat.
Well, Joe Dombrowski, who is riding Tour de Suisse, talked a little bit in our friend's special that was released last week, just after the Giro. He did a diary for us during the Giro, and it is a fantastic listen. It's had a tremendous response. Thank you very much to everybody who has given us some feedback on that. But Joe kept an audio diary, and he talked a little bit about this in that, the phenomenon of what you do after a Grand Tour. And, you know, if you stop, the body just shuts down. And the important thing is actually to keep training, and keep training quite hard, and then you kind of certainly keep your form for a few weeks. I should also mention that in a couple of weeks, Joe Dombrowski will be in London, and we're working on putting on an event with him. It'll be on Thursday the 23rd of June, location, venue to be confirmed, but stay tuned. We'll release details about where and when you can see Joe Dombrowski in London in a couple of weeks. So, the Dauphiné. Daniel, you're there. Tell us about it.
Well, three stages and a prologue down, and with the big mountain stages coming over the weekend. The prologue was a very untypical prologue, as you probably saw. It was a mountaintop prologue, 4 very steep kilometres, and a finish at Leger, won by Alberto Contador, who, won the first battle with Chris Froome, beaten by, I think it was 8 seconds, am I right in saying? I'm here, but you guys probably following the results more closely than me.
13 seconds, wasn't it?
Well, it was close, but Contador seems to be in better form than, well, he seems to have come into this race in slightly better form than Froome. There were a few concerns about Froome's form. Coming into the Dauphiné, but he seems to be going pretty well. And, you know, it's a hilly stage yesterday that finished in the Auvergne. And there were various attacks in the finale from Mikel Landa, Sergio Henao, Mikhail Kwiatkowski. Froome himself didn't move, but he did. He told me after the finish that he was tempted at one point to have a bit of a go. So, yeah, bubbling up nicely. And then today we saw another would-be Tour de France contender, Fabio Aru, who has not been going well so far in the Dauphiné, has come in a bit undercooked, has been at altitude for a long time leading up to this race. Didn't ride well in the prologue, but attacked today on the final climb and rode away to the finish and held on. And it was really quite an incredible solo breakaway to hold off the chasing pack.
And a surprising one, wasn't it? I know Alexander Kristoff was very angry behind it. You wouldn't have put much money on him holding off that field, because there were still quite a lot of fast finishes there, weren't there? The prologue, Daniel, yeah, it was short and it was a bit bizarre, uphill, short time trial, but a test like that is quite revealing of form, isn't it? And, you know, that was quite... Froome went early, had some pretty good conditions before the rain came, and it looked like his time was going to be good enough, but Contador very impressive in winning that, and it does suggest that he's in extremely good shape, unlike last year.
Yeah, and he seems to be in a very good mood as well. He's very, very relaxed, smiley, happy. You know, today he had a bit of a problem on the final descent, and he had to get a hand sling, actually, at one point from one of his teammates, his Tinkoff teammates, Robert Kieselowski, which is not strictly legal, but Contador made light of that at the finish, and he said that although the descent was quite sketchy and quite risky and people were going very, very fast, he's really feeling no stress at all here at the Dauphiné. And of course, it's a race that he's never won. So you would imagine that it was one gap on his palmarès that he would quite like to fill. But he really doesn't seem overly fussed about keeping the jersey. He's very much focused on the Tour de France.
Rich, you said there that you thought it was a bit of a bizarre prologue. I actually thought it was a terrific sort of, not something that we normally see.
As in unusual, really.
Yeah, but it was unusual in a good way. I did see a few people, Tony Martin, saying that it reduced world-class riders to rolling uphill at sort of 18 kilometres an hour or whatever it was, and a bit of a circus. But I completely disagree with that. I think that, you know, having little stages like this that are different, add a bit of variety, and you see all of, as you said there, basically you get a very, very good idea of who is going well in, what, 11 and a half, 12 minutes of racing.
Yeah, and I think the right place for a 20% climb might be on the very first day, you know, in a 4-kilometre prologue when people are still fresh. And I can kind of understand what Tony Martin's saying, in the sense that, you know, stages or races finishing on climbs like the Angliru and the Zonkalan have been criticised before because they're extremely steep, and the riders are almost reduced to sort of, you know, weekend plodders, aren't they? They go really slowly, and I couldn't see why some people might object to that, but I thought that it really was a success, the prologue here on Sunday.
Yeah, fantastic entertainment.
What about Monday's stage then, and the... Well, the Nasser Bouhanni's antics and the shoulder barging and headbutting that went on in the run-up. Daniel, what was the kind of the fallout from that? Because we've seen riders get disqualified for similar or even, you know, even less, and Bouhanni kind of got away with it, really. Certainly a lot of the riders seem to be pointing the finger at him, saying he'd been a lucky boy.
Well, I think it was more his teammate. The finger was being pointed more at his teammates, particularly Christophe Laporte, who's actually been pretty impressive this year in his lead-out train. But there was sort of rutting between between Laporte and Jacopo Guarnieri of Katusha, and I thought it was, you know, in the words of every football pundit ever, it was six of one, half a dozen of the other, Jeff.
Handbags.
It was. But it's interesting that Cofidis seems to be going out of their way to alienate other teams, and they're already a fairly, I wouldn't say unpopular bunch, but there is this issue that we touched on a few months ago when Arno Demar won Milan-San Remo and there were suggestions that he'd held onto a car or been drafting behind a car, and it was the Italian riders that really rounded on Demar. And I think Monday's stage really underlined again that the French teams are still not particularly popular, and Cofidis are particularly unpopular, partly because of Bahani's fairly rough and ready approach to sprinting. But Bahani really doesn't go out of his way to butter anyone up or rebuild bridges when he's upset people. He's got this real swagger about him, which kind of makes him attractive. He's something different from a fan's point of view. But certainly in the peloton, they're not winning any friends.
The thing is, you say that six of one, half a dozen of the other. The thing is, at 40 miles an hour, you know, that those sorts of antics are incredibly dangerous, and they're putting a lot of other riders in real danger as well. I wonder if it's almost a strategic thing, though, as well, with Cofidis. You know, they're asserting their authority and making other teams perhaps slightly apprehensive, even nervous of being around them. You know, if really asserting themselves in a very aggressive way, and we've seen teams assert themselves and you know, make it clear that their place is at the front like that, but to do so in such a physical way could just be a way of almost commanding that space and keeping other teams out their way.
Yeah, and there's definitely a line that shouldn't be crossed, and there are riders and teams who think that Cofidis are crossing the line. I mean, Bahani's sprinting itself is still, to me, looks very, very dangerous in the sense that he always sprints with his head down and he does move across the road a lot. But as far as sort of just holding your ground is concerned, I think Laporte and Geoffroy Soup are really, who are the main lead-out men for Bahani, are really sort of changing the image of Cofidis, because Cofidis have been seen as this kind of soft-bellied, underachieving, shambolic outfit for years and years. And
Cofidis disappointing, I'll say it just before lining.
They are. And Bahani has come in with this, as I said, this real kind of swagger about him, and they're showing that they're not to be messed with, really, and they are prepared to put noses out of joint.
So lastly then, what can we look forward to over the last 4 days of the Dauphiné, Daniel? I know we've got the big finish, I guess, is the one at Méribel. Is that where it's going to all boil down, or will Sunday be will people wait till Sunday, and do you think that there'll be a full-on sort of shootout, or is this still just the shadow boxing before the tour?
No, I think that's right, Lionel. I think the key stage will be to Méribel on Saturday. We've got the Col de la Madeleine, which comes fairly early in that stage, almost 2,000 metres. And whenever that climb is included on the Tour de France route, we always see huge damage. And it comes before a summit finish at Méribel. And then the sort of extra time, injury time, is the stage on Sunday to Super Dévolu. And there will be opportunities there to sort of repair whatever damage has been done on the stage to Méribel. But certainly talking to a few riders this week, Richie Porte, for example, Contador, Froome, their eyes and their sort of thoughts are very much focused on the stage to Méribel. So should be a decent weekend of action, and also Friday's stage is a hilly one as well, so which could cause some damage. So yeah, three big stages to finish off the Dauphiné.
Hello, my name is Charlene Joyner and I ride for Team Ford EcoBoost. You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast in association with the Poppy Scotland Sportif. Three rides over some of the most spectacular roads in Scotland on September the 25th. For more information, see poppyscotland.org.uk.
So we heard there from Charlene Joyner, Scottish cyclist, former Commonwealth Games medalist, and she was flagging up something that we're promoting throughout June on the Cycling Podcast, and that is the Poppy Scotland Sportif, one of the best sportif rides in the UK. Check it out at poppyscotland.org.uk. There are three different routes, over 47 miles, or if you're Daniel, 77 kilometres, 6 to 8 miles, 110 kilometres, or 100 miles, 162 kilometres. Lots of climbing. It's in East Lothian on fantastic roads that I know extremely well. And it's a really good event. It's an unusual sportif in that all the money, all the entry fee goes to the charity. They have help from partners who fund all the costs, operational costs and so on. So all the money goes to what is a very worthy charity. So we're going to be proudly promoting the Poppy Scotland Sportif on 25th of September throughout June. There you go. Can any of you guys be persuaded to do that?
Possibly, yeah.
Great. When?
You're,
September?
You're in, Lionel.
September?
End of September.
Maybe.
I'm up for it. Anyway, I don't know which route yet. We'll figure that out a bit later on. Listen, we've got a long interview to play. Well, part one of a long interview with Graham Bartlett, who is the chief executive of Velon, an organisation that's been around for just over a year. And it's 11 of the top World Tour teams are part of Velon. They're shareholders in Velon. And Graham Bartlett is employed by them to really look at ways to develop the sport. And the Tour of Switzerland, Tour de Suisse, which begins this weekend, is really a key event for them. They have entered into a partnership with Tour de Suisse for doing all kinds of things in relation to broadcasting, on-bike cameras and so on, and other things that we'll reveal more about in next week's second part of the interview. So we'll be playing that in a minute. Daniel and I went to visit him quite recently at their London offices, didn't we, Daniel?
We did.
Yeah, that was an interesting chat, Rich and Daniel. I couldn't make it on that particular day. And I must admit, before hearing from Graham Bartlett, I had a certain amount of scepticism about Velon, the whole idea and concept of Velon and the sort of rush. I perceived it as a kind of rush to monetize and develop the sport for really commercial gain. And while I recognize that, you know, any major sport has to keep bringing in money, it has to be attractive to sponsors, and professional cycling is incredibly precarious. We keep losing major sponsors. I mean, we've seen already, haven't we, I Am Cycling are pulling out at the end of this year. Other sponsorships are hanging in the balance. The perennial problem for these big teams, as their budgets get bigger and their assets, their riders get more expensive, is funding. And but yeah, I'm always a bit uncomfortable about the idea of sort of rushing to try and squeeze coins out of a sport which is, you know, has got fairly humble roots. But when I listened to Graham Bartlett talking and realised that there's more to it, I was kind of won over a little bit by the way he was talking about trying to broaden the sport's appeal and make it so that it is easier for people to understand if they just stumble across it, because it can be incomprehensible, can't it? I mean, we try our best to explain how particularly the stage races are working, but there's so much going on that you really have to pay a lot of attention or you are missing a great deal of the nuance and intrigue that's going on. And I think anything that can be done to bring a bit of that out has to be to the benefit of the sport overall. I'm just not wildly sold on the phenomenon of on-bike cameras. The footage does tend to leave me a little bit cold, but you know, that's the direction they're going in at the moment, and it is an obvious kind of win for them, is to, you know, take the viewer into the peloton. I can see exactly why they're doing it, but I'd like to see more focus on mixing up the racing formats, really. And the Dauphiné Prologue we've seen a few days ago is an example of that, where it's something a little bit extreme, a little bit different. I'd like to see a real sort of think tank of brainiacs get together and think about how they can make the actual formats of racing more appealing to a TV audience. And maybe that's something that Velon will look at in the coming months and years.
I'll tell you what, if Velon don't achieve anything else, breaking down some of your scepticism, Lionel, that's quite a feather in Graham Bartlett's cap already.
That's something that we've never managed to do, isn't it, Rich?
About
issue whatsoever. Anyway.
Well, yeah, no. So before we hear from Graham Bartlett, let's look ahead a little bit to the Tour de Suisse. Now, I think when the partnership was announced between Velon and the race, given the teams that are involved in Velon, so many of the big players, very few teams, Movistar are not part of Velon, but generally speaking, the top teams are part of Velon. So we imagine that a lot of the top riders would be riding in Switzerland rather than at the Dauphiné. That's not really proved to be the case, you know, with Contador, Froome, Port, and others all at the Dauphiné. But nevertheless, Suisse does have a decent field. There's TJ Van Garderen there, the other BMC leader. We've got Rui Costa, Geraint Thomas is leading Team Sky there. Warren Barguil for Giant Alpecin, very interested to see how he gets on. But what else do we have to look forward to at the race itself, Daniel?
Well, over the past few years, Rich, the Tour de Suisse has really struggled to show Switzerland off as a tourist destination. And this is a new focus that the race has got under the race director, David Loosley. I mean, he's spoken in the press over the last few years about the difficulty of doing exactly what he wants to do with the route and financial imperatives. And there's been this, I think, a 3-year agreement with a ski resort in Austria, bizarrely, that talk about sort of coals to, well, it's not really coals to Newcastle, is it? I've got my sort of idiom slightly mixed up there. But yeah, when you're basing a race in Switzerland, then you go to Austria for a mountaintop finish. That's slightly odd. However, they've had to go there for 3 years. This is going to be the last year, and they haven't really visited the classic, the great passes of Switzerland. And Switzerland, for my money, has probably the best, the most spectacular mountain passes in Europe. This year, they have managed
better than Dolomites.
Well, I would say so. I mean, in terms of the road engineering and the landscape, I think Switzerland is...
Are there any Dolomites in Switzerland?
No, there are not. But Switzerland is pretty hard to beat on that score. This year, there are some incredible passes on the races. We've got the Fluela, the Albula, the Furka, the Gotthard, and then we've got that big mountaintop finisher, the Rettenbachfurner in Austria. So the race actually goes over 2,000 metres, and we talked about this a lot at the Giro, how many times that race went over 2,000 metres. It was 10 times. The Tour de Suisse goes over 2,000 metres 5 times in just 9 stages, and the Tour de France in 21 stages goes over 2,000 metres just 4 times. So
wow,
a lot of high mountains, big grandstand finale at Davos and mountain stage on the final day. Usually it finishes with a time trial. This year it finishes with a mountain stage, so a lot of high jinks, so to speak.
I tell you, if they want to show off what Switzerland has to offer, they could just make it a 2-day race at the weekend. Stage one, a criterium going past all the banks in Geneva, and then stage two, just round the lakes, passing all the international sports bodies, federations' headquarters. There we are. Job done.
You're a cold-hearted, bitter, cynical man, Lionel Burney.
All of that's certainly true, yes.
We've already established that. Listen, without further ado and without speculating too much, because we're talking a lot about races that are either ongoing or still to happen, we should go to their Graham Bartlett interview, I think. I mentioned earlier the Joe Dombrowski special, the audio diary, which has gone down really well. A reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com for £10 for 11 special episodes. And there's been a lot of you signing up since our Giro coverage, so we really appreciate it. Thanks very much. It helps to keep us going and keep us going to races. So thank you. Next one we'll all be at, of course, will be the Tour de France, I think. Anyway, shall we go to Graham Bartlett, and then we'll come back in and say our goodbyes. Here's Graham Bartlett. Okay, Graham, we're in your office in High Street, Kensington, here in London. Don't know if I'm allowed to reveal the secret offices of Velon. But tell us, first of all, who are you? What's your background? How did you get involved with Velon?
Well, definitely the first thing to say is we're not secret. Velon's a very public organisation. We like to try and get out and tell people who we are and what we are and what we're doing. My role in Velon is I am the CEO. I work for the company. I work for my 11 shareholders and the shareholders in Velon. It is a company. It's a UK incorporated company. It has 11 shareholders and those are the 11 teams. So I work for them.
What's your own background? In you've worked in sport in the past, haven't you? In football, is that right?
I worked in a number of sports. Yeah, I started off working for a company called ISL, which had an interesting history. And then I worked from there. I went to UEFA, and then I left UEFA. I worked for Nike. I ran sports marketing for Nike here in the UK and Ireland. I worked briefly at Liverpool Football Club. I was the commercial director there for a short period. And then I went to work at Sky Sports. And when I was there, there were various projects that I was asked to look at, be responsible for. And there was a project in cycling. And that project became, the best way to describe it, I suppose, would be a sort of nascent collaboration between the teams as to what they might do together. And we did various studies and meetings and thoughts and brainstorming. And over the period of time that they were doing that, which was about a year, it was something at the time, it was called the Avion Project, which was referred to now and again in the press. And that became a collaboration that became more and more solid between the teams, and ultimately it led to the formation of the company in September the 5th, 2014. And we launched on the 23rd of November, 2014. So yeah, Velon is just over a year old.
Did you have any knowledge really of cycling prior to this?
A little bit, but you know, not very much. I think when I took on the role, because when they formed the company, I was expecting the teams to say, okay, the project is finished, the company is formed, and now we go and bring the people in who are cycling experts and understand the sport very, very well, which certainly was not me. But they took a position to say, actually, we think it might be a benefit if somebody comes in from outside of the cycling world. They chose that deliberately.
Well, some people say that one of cycling's problems as a business model has been perhaps too many people steeped in cycling and too few people with outside expertise, business experience, marketing experience in particular. What were your impressions then of the way the sport was set up, the way that it was structured when you began to get to grips with this weird, wonderful sport?
It is a wonderful sport. I think it's, I like the phrase, it certainly wasn't mine. I think it was RCS that I first heard it from. It's beautifully complicated. And I think that describes pro cycling very well. It's beautifully complicated. And the more you get to know it, the more interesting and exciting it is. My impressions of it, that firstly, I think, was the passion of the people. The people who run these teams, who ride in these teams, who put on these races are just incredibly passionate about the sport, which is great to see, and you can really get swept along with that. And any sport that's got that is you know, doing all right, doing well. But from a business perspective, they had the sport is set up because of its history in a certain direction, in a certain way, and that's not the most efficient or it's not the best way of setting it up. And I think everybody within the sport recognises that. But it's very difficult to change the historical course and to move that. And that requires a lot of work by a lot of people to do that.
Well, you've worked in sports that have been very successful at generating lots of money and sharing that money, I guess. You know, you look at Liverpool are taking a huge share of television money. Cycling might be unique and be entirely dependent on commercial sponsors. And as you say, there are historic reasons for that. But is that model, is that actually viable in today's media landscape where, you know, it's so crowded? Does a company having its name on a cycling team's jersey as a marketing man, is that a good way for a company to spend their money?
I'm going to have to say yes to that because my shareholders are all funded by that model.
Okay, then what I mean is the model whereby all the money comes from the sponsor viable?
Whenever this discussion happens, people immediately jump into this sort of revenue share and TV revenue share position. And I think that's jumping to the wrong kind of conclusions. The starting point really is if you look at the success in other sports, and it's not just about the money, it's about the success of the sport. You know, how does it grow its fan base? How does it become more popular? How does it attract new fans while keeping its existing passionate heartbeat of fans? And the single biggest factor is both sides or all sides of the sport joining up. The athletes, the teams, the competition organizer and the governing body, everybody coming together and saying, look, we've got a common purpose here. We've all got the stake in the sport moving forward and we're going to do that together. And that was one of the rationales behind Velon is you can't do something with the other side, with everybody else in the mix, unless you can get yourselves coordinated on your side and bring something to the table that matters. So if you want to do business with a race organizer as one team, it's a struggle. Do it as 11, then you can offer more. The point was aggregate what we've got on our side and then go to the rest of the stakeholders and say, we've got this, what can we build with you that you need from us? So it's a collaborative business model. It's a business model where people start to share and join up. The race organizer looks for sponsors. The teams look for sponsors. They don't talk to each other. That's crazy. Sponsorship, you're all looking for sponsorship. What have we got on our side that could help you sell your sponsorship? What have you got on your side that could help us sell ours? Let's sell them together. Because if you don't join up, you can't make better business. So, and again, it's not just about the money. It's about how do you promote the race? How do you better show people what the sport is? How do you excite them more? You can do it much easier if you're together.
I suppose what I was saying earlier and to play devil's advocate, you could argue that the sport has survived for 100 years with the model that currently in the same model that exists now. Now, whether it could have been better, or you know, whether riders were underpaid, whether the sport lost opportunities to develop and grow, it has survived. That model has worked, you know, and we do have in the Tour de France one of the world's biggest, most popular annual sporting events. So if you were playing devil's advocate, you'd say, well, it is working. So why is this necessary now? What's changed?
Well, first of all, I would say that, you know, does it survive or not survive if Velon or this common business model? Of course it does. I mean, it'd be stupid to say otherwise. Of course it will survive. It's not a question about whether it survives. It's a question of whether it does better. If you just want to keep things as they were because it works, then that's fine. But I don't believe that the people who work in cycling on any side of the fence are in it because of that. Everybody that I've seen is so passionate and driven about this, doesn't go home at night and think, thank goodness the sport stayed as it was. They give up an enormous amount of their lives and their time. They say, well, I want to make it better. And how do you judge that? By making it better. More people love it. More people understand it. More people are riding bikes, watching people, watching races. All of these are metrics that you would judge a sport by. Is it driving himself forward in that regard?
There is this perception, Graham, that cycling is a sport that is punching beneath its weight and has punched beneath its weight for a long time, that there is this latent audience there is not being tapped into. But as a counterpoint to that, there's also a suspicion that it is exactly where it should be, that perhaps we exaggerate what a fantastic spectacle it is sometimes. And ultimately, I mean, to use a phrase once employed by an Italian rider, a guy called Marzio Brizzaghian, it's 200 idiots trying to get across a white line. And perhaps this is as big and as wonderful as cycling will ever be. But you obviously think that there is a latent potential, that a lot of the people who have got into cycling over the last few years and ride bikes but are not currently following professional cycling, that maybe that is the big untapped market.
Well, I think the point you make is absolutely right, that there is a big untapped market there. But I wouldn't even describe it as a market. I would say it's a potential. And, you know, you can reduce any sport to so many idiots doing something stupid. I mean, that description could be labelled on any sport. I think the point that you make, though, is, which I completely agree with, is there is a great potential there, that people are taking up the sport, and yet how many of them are really excited or interested in or following the elite sport? I think that's very questionable, and I think that's unfortunate, because in other sports they really benefit from that. Any park you go to, if you see a bunch of kids playing cricket or playing football or playing another sport, the chances are they're also going to watch their heroes later on that day. And that, the data that we see coming from the sport, is that there's a bit of a mismatch there, that whilst there is a growth in popularity in taking it up, that's not really translating through, certainly, to some of the pro races. Some of the numbers on the races and the viewing figures are growing and others not. And there's not a correlation between the expansion of the sport as a sport, people taking up and participating in it, and then relating that back to excitement in the top level, which is, it's a miss. If you really want your sport to grow, you want to make the virtuous circle there, drive participation, drive excitement in the elite end of the sport, and they'll drive each other. That's just healthy for any sport, and you want to make that connection. And from Velon's perspective, what we want to do is make the race come alive more. For everybody who's buying a bike and riding around and getting into the sport, we want to make the elite race really as exciting and as open and as accessible and as animated and as interesting as we can by working with the race organisers, working with the race broadcasters. We announced Infront as a partner. That's very much about doing that, building that technology platform that starts to add extra dimensions to what you can look at from the race.
I think a lot of what you've done so far and what you want to accomplish also with race organisers is essentially about repackaging the sport and making it look better and making it more attractive. But to what extent do you think that the professional sport, professional cycling, has been kneecapped, sort of hobnailed for the medium term, certainly by doping scandals over the past 20 years? You know, we had a special podcast a couple of weeks ago with about HTC, one of the most successful teams of the last 20 years, and we talked about why that team essentially couldn't find a sponsor in the end and essentially folded. And, you know, the factor that their owner, Bob Stapleton, kept going back to was doping and every conversation he would have with prospective sponsors, in spite of this fantastic product he had, was jeopardised by that image of professional cycling?
If the sport doesn't move away from its history, then it's very hard to advance from everybody's perspective. And I think that everybody within the sport understands that, knows that, and is working towards that. I would say that my perception, and I'm certainly not any kind of expert on this area, and this is not Velon's role within the sport, certainly not. That's for other people to take forward. But I would say, coming from outside the sport, I think what cycling has done has held itself to incredibly high standards and put systems in place which are, you know, the envy of a lot of other sports. And it'd be very interesting to see if you shone the light of scrutiny as strongly as cycling has on another sport, what you might find. And cycling has been doing it for a very long time, and I think people should give them credit for that, because they have. HTC is a very sad example, but I think there's more to it than that. I'm not saying that what you've quoted there, Bob Stapleton, is wrong or not. I fully accept that it's correct, but it also illustrates another point, that the only way you could fund the team was by finding sponsorship money. And if you have a single strand of revenue in any business, you are potentially exposed. When that market contracts, you've got a problem. If you remove one limb of revenue from a business that has five limbs of revenue, it can survive, it can adjust, it can change and remain. But if it has only one strand and you remove that or drastically reduce it, then it dies. And operating a sports team like that is incredibly difficult. It makes it very, very hard. And it's bad for the sport. All fans like consistency. They like to see their rider in that jersey, in that team there every year. And the sport has very much tried to move away from here today, gone tomorrow, and get away from the HTC position, because they know that the long-term health of pro cycling is that people can follow it on a very long-term basis. Get excited, stay excited, come back and watch again, regardless of whether that rider is with that team. It's still my team. You know, I was a Liverpool fan as a boy, so, you know, I've seen some greats come and go. But when, you know, Kevin Keegan left, I didn't stop supporting them. When Kenny Dalglish retired, I didn't stop supporting them. It's still my team. And that's sports fans, and cycling is a team sport. You know, it's wonderful individuals within a team sport. And we've got to move away from that singular strand of revenue so that we don't have a situation where these teams are really on the edge of going bust on the basis they lose a sponsor.
Can we just run through some of the concrete things that you have been able to accomplish so far, and some of the sort of landmark moments and the big breakthroughs that Velon has had? And, you know, I'm thinking in particular about the onboard camera footage that you were able to introduce and use in several races last year. But you can talk to us a bit about that and some of the other things that you've already accomplished.
I think the first accomplishment goes back to those 11 shareholders themselves informing that company. That was a big step. I mean, they took a real leap of faith there. They all shook hands with each other and said, we're going to form this company, we're going to give this company some of our assets, and we're going to fund it, and we're going to go out there and see if we can make something happen here. That, to me, is an overlooked landmark move. It was very brave of them. A lot of those people who made that step did it knowing that, you know what, I may not be around to see the benefits of this, because this is a long-term thing. It was 12, actually, because we had two teams who merged at the beginning. But those 12 people who set that up and did that, they deserve a lot of credit in this sport. And I think that sometimes gets overlooked. But going on from there, what did the company do? Well, we've been around for just over a year. And very clearly, we saw that there's some immediate advantages you can take. We weren't the first people to put cameras on bikes. You know, it's been done a long time ago. But perhaps we were the first people who saw that you could do it differently. And we did it in the Tour de Suisse the first time we did that. And we said, look, we'll do a lot of cameras and we'll capture a lot of footage, because it's onboard cameras is a bit like fishing. The bigger your net, the more chance you've got of catching some good fish. So we did a really very professional operation to set up what we could get. And we started to get much more exciting footage. And then GoPro came along and saw what we were doing. And GoPro was something that was started off by ASO. Because ASO had the first conversations with GoPro. They were talking to them for quite a while. And then we looked at a position where I say, look, if you could combine great races with what we're doing and with a great team setup, then you could do something really special. And that was a landmark position, because that was something that came into the sport. There's not many big international companies, and GoPro are a genuine international company. And the way that they relay sport short form content, big YouTube position, GoPro channels. That's exciting for the sport to tap into that. So that was a good move. That was a really good move. We did something with them last year. We're hoping to see if we can do something with them again this year. So that was another milestone, I think, to do that. And then, of course, last week we announced a new partnership with Infront Sports Media, who are a fantastic sports agency, one of the most respected in the sector. And we worked very hard to bring them as a partner to Velo. And we're delighted to have them on board. We've signed a 10-year deal. It has a number of different elements to it. First one we're focusing on is on technology, because having done the delayed onboard camera, we'd like to move much more to a live position. And data. We really want to bring the performance data out of the race and show people just how amazing these athletes are and how incredible it is what they do. But also to help people understand the sport. You guys, you know it very, very well. You watch a race and you see 15 things that I wouldn't see, but we want to be able to illustrate those things so that everybody can understand them and see them and realize the brilliance that's there. Let's bring it out, put it on the screen. So that's a big part of what we're doing with Infront. We want them to bring more big international sponsors to the sport, which is another task that they've been undertaking. And they're fantastically well placed to do that because they're a really strong agency. And then there's the developing the proposition we have with the race organisers. How do we fit together better with them? With Infront, we can do far more with the race organisers. I've had so many meetings with race organisers where I've talked about things that we want to do this and we like to do this and we will do this. And now it's, we can do this. We are doing this. We're going to do this. And that's great. And that's because of Infront, because it gives so much more substance to what Velon's position hasn't changed. It's just become so much more substantive as a result of having this fantastic partner in Infront Sports and Media.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our friend specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our friend specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 friend specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
So that was part one of our Graham Bartlett interview. Part two will come next week. It was interesting, I think, and we cover a bit more ground next week. And of course, as the Tour de Suisse unfolds, we'll know a little bit more about what the partnership between Velon and the race actually means and what it entails. Watch this space, I guess. We should wrap things up for this week. You've got a race to cover, Daniel, and Lionel and I, I'm sure, have got things to do.
Yeah. Yeah. We have. Well,
great.
I've got some Côte d'Aron to drink as well. Of course. Did I talk about wine? Did I talk about wine earlier? I was very excited today because the finish line at the Dauphiné was sort of overlooked by two very famous, the vineyards of two very famous wine producers. Chapoutier, you might know the Braille labels for the Côte d'Aron or Tane Hermitage wine in England. Don't know if you're interested in that, Richard or Lionel, but yeah.
I sense a kilometre zero coming along, but maybe we'll have a little wine association at the Tour de France. Who knows? Might have the opportunity to talk a bit more about wine there. Should we wrap it up for tonight, guys? We'll be back next week with another regular episode. Also next week is our very first The Cycling Podcast Femina, our monthly new episode focused on women's racing and female riders. And I will be joined for that by Orla Chinoui. And we'll have lots of interviews and looking ahead to the women's tour. And yeah, lots of really good stuff, really excited about it. And it's coming out, it should be out next Tuesday on the eve of the women's tour. So that's something to look forward to. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel, over there in France.
Thank you, chaps. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.